All right, good morning. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about tropical medicine and combating this global epidemic of chronic diseases. And I know BMO just spent some time talking about obesity and diabetes and things like that. But the chronic inflammation really seems to be the nexus of, you know, a lot of different diseases, cancer, Alzheimer's, things like asthma, cardiovascular health. And this whole notion that as we grow and as we develop, you know, we continue to produce an inflammatory environment in our body, thus producing deleterious effects in the long term. And you can see here the amount of inflammatory diseases with, you know, stroke, and you have other things with diabetes over here in the blue. I don't know if I have a pointer. We'll try this one. And then you've got heart disease as well as obesity. And you can also see that the southeastern United States is also a real center for a lot of these diseases and have a much higher rate of incidences compared to the rest of the U.S. and quite correlatively with BMU's one slide with the fruit and vegetable consumption, you can see those same states that are red or orange or blue or purple, those areas also don't have a lot of fruit and vegetable consumption. So our primary focus is on cancer. And one of the primary ideas related to cancer is that this chronic unresolved inflammation might create a very high risk for common cancers. And that one way tumors survive is they corrupt this inflammatory process. One, knowing that the body is going to be in an inflammatory situation and use that to its advantage. So these are a lot of inflammatory syndromes that can lead to different cancers, like inflammatory bowel disease increases your risk for colorectal cancer, chronic pancreatitis for pancreatic cancer, and so on and so forth down the line. You can see that this, you know, chronic inflammation really is not a healthful situation to be in. And so there's, you know, probably two detrimental forces at work. This idea of acculturation, when people will give up their traditional cultural and dietary practices and adopt new unhealthy patterns. And then this phytochemical depletion. So replacement of these natural phytochemical sources with high-calorie, easy-access foods, low and you know, natural product content. So this is a typical weekly diet of a family in the country of Chad. And you can see that of being very sparse, there's also a lot of grain and a few fruits and vegetables and spices. This is in India. This is Turkey. China, Italy, and this is Great Britain, this is Guatemala and Mexico. While the front of this picture looks really nice, the back of it is a little disconcerting with about 2 liters of Coke for a family of five. And this is the United States. And so you can see that, you know, somewhat as you sort of move through the developing world and, you know, the undeveloped to the developed world, what did you notice? You know, the fruits and vegetables and the colorful sections were replaced by colorful sections of cardboard and mass-produced items. And so it's really a scary idea, you know, can we mitigate this shift? One of the largest increases in cancer incidence is occurring in the continent of Africa. And it's this idea, you know, is this notion of being too rich to eat healthy a problem? And that is, as these developed countries, underdeveloped countries develop, they see, oh, well, we can be like the U.S. I mean, currently they're opening 700 Kentucky Fried Chickens a year in China. 700. So before you guys leave at lunchtime today, they will have already built one, which is a pretty staggering amount of production, and that's just one chain. You think about all the other types of fast food and convenience factors that the developed countries really utilize in their life. And so the other idea is, you know, is it what we're eating? You know, are we eating poorly? Are we eating all of these things? I think we can also say yes. And, you know, is it what we're not eating? I think this is also yes. You know, we're losing out on some of those things that have a lot of these beneficial health factors. And so this idea of ethnopharmacology has been around for a long, long time. And it looks at, you know, maintaining the linkage of these lifestyles and practices that, you know, a lot of our ancient cultures had prior to having all of these mass-produced and I would say, you know, probably calorically dense foods with not a lot of beneficial compounds in them for our health. You know, they ate, they foraged, they did everything locally. They had a mixed diet. And then, you know, as we develop and, you know, surprisingly, as we grow closer as a world with technology and the internet and transportation, we lose a lot of that. You know, everyone wants to sort of be someone else. And some of those things that get lost are a lot of these things related to history and, you know, the culture and diet. And so there's this idea of, you know, cancer chemo prevention, which is really the focus of our lab. And it's sort of an opportunity to provide, you know, higher quality of symptom-free and pain-free lives and, you know, try to keep the cancer from becoming invasive, metastatic, or even developing in the first place. And so one of the things I'm going to focus on is oral cancer and a little bit on colon cancer today. And the first thing that brought us along with this was the relationship of periodontitis with chronic inflammation. So chronic inflammation can, you know, be a factor in many of these diseases I mentioned earlier, as well as within the oral cavity of humans. And so many years ago, they found, you know, that the high dose of retinoids is effective in preventing these oral pre-metastatic lesions. But this retinoic use has some serious side effects. You have to watch your liver enzymes. It can be very toxic to your liver and things like that. And so you have a high rate of occurrence, of reoccurrence from this study after they were taken off of the retinoid. So it seemed to be just a very specific and short-lived effect. And, you know, a lower dose, which seemed to remove the side effects, you know, didn't have much of an effect on reducing the cancers for the head and neck. So this becomes, you know, a problem. Is, you know, too much toxic is not enough ineffective, and, you know, what are the side effects when you're talking about doing a chemo preventative study, which is, you know, the backbone of that is chronic, low dose, long term exposure. And so aspirin is probably one of the most well known chemo preventative agents. You can see that it's been shown with reduction in head and neck cancer, and NSAIDs have also shown to be, you know, positive in some of the studies, but it's not without its own issues. Long-term aspirin usage has been shown to create ulcers and have problems with the stomach lining. Nowadays, you see the coated aspirin that they recommend and things like that. But still, to date, it's one of the most rigorously studied chemo preventative agents, and it is a natural product, although it is synthesized these days. And the other thing that we tend to look at is, what is a marker that we can analyze when we're doing these studies that we know is corrupted in cancers or in these diseases, and we can see that our fruits, our vegetables, our compound of interest is having an effect. And one of the most popular ones in terms of inflammation is COX-2. I think a lot of people know that, you know, overexpression of COX-2, especially in oral cavity, is a higher risk for malignant lesions. And the same thing with squamous cell carcinomas, which is another type of oral cancer. And so this increase in COX-2 is associated with a much higher risk of mortality and, you know, a secondary primary cancer. Once you go through treatment, you get radiation, chemo, surgery. Even if you don't do anything with the COX, you know, in terms of analyzing the COX-2 expression, you can also have increase the chance of reoccurrence. So, you know, this use of systemic suppressants of inflammation, you know, they've had mixed results. Retinoids, Vioxx, everyone knows the Celebrex issue with heart disease and things like that, with the exception of aspirin. You know, the NSAID toxicity is still a serious complication for public health use. You know, natural products, as we all know, whether they're from fruits, vegetables, leaves, bark, things like that, they have a large inventory in preclinical models of showing anti-inflammatory agents. For instance, curcumin from turmeric has showed promise in preclinical studies with head and neck cancers in humans up to, you know, 8 grams a day. You know, so without retinoids and things like that, are there other compounds that we can look at? And so one of the major compounds that we work with is from the plant neem, which is grown in India and some of the tropical regions in the Southeast Asia, and it's called the poor man's toothbrush. A lot of people there in that part, you know, they don't get adequate dental care, but they can take a small branch off the tree, break it, peel the bark, and they just brush their teeth with it, and it actually provides a very effective dental care. The primary class of bioactives are limonoids. It's very bitter tasting. You know, here's that bitter again. But it's highly anti-inflammatory. So it presents, you know, sort of all the characteristics that we want in terms of a chemopreventative type agent. And, you know, this, the anecdotal as well as just historical data with neem has been around for, you know, 5,000 years. And it's not only used just for oral care, it's used as an insecticide, antifungal to clean, antiseptic. I mean, this this tree and the leaves and everything like that have multiple uses in traditional Ayurvedic medicine and the Indian lifestyle. And so within the neem itself, when we look at isolating, you know, compounds or trying to get signatures as to, you know, what are the active components. With the supercritical extract that we work with, we can isolate a lot of different compounds. But some of these, like nimbolide, azadirachtin A, quercetin, these have been studied individually and have shown to have a lot of anti-inflammatory and antioxidant effects in cells. And if you look at just published reports of neem and human research, you can see that, you know, wound healing treatment and investigating with malaria, the dermal infestation, so skin lesions. There's even been work going on with contraception, insect repellents, and things like that. So it has a whole litany of different types of health benefits. And so, as I mentioned earlier, what we work with is a supercritical extract of this, the leaves of this plant, using CO2 under heat and pressure, basically create the gas and turn it into a liquid, extract everything from the leaves, and then you can decrease the pressure, drive off the CO2, and you're left with a very pure extract of this plant. And so instead of, you know, trying to focus on an alcohol extract or methanol extract, we can get an idea of looking at all of the possible beneficial compounds that are in this plant in a much more regimented fashion, because with the CO2, it's done the same way every time. So we can get an idea of the same type of class of compounds and the concentrations from batch to batch, and keep the quality control and everything like that together. And so one of the ways we do this is by looking at this compound nimbolide within the leaf, and we can do some mass spec and take, you know, our nimbolide standard and then run our supercritical extract through the HPLC and mass spec and see that, you know, we have similar levels. And the reason there's some other peaks in there with the nimbolide is the standard from the company we get, they don't guarantee 100% purity of nimbolide. So We do see some similar peaks with our SCO2, but we still see that we've got, you know, nimbleite in here. So we know that we're dealing with a concentrated leaf extract. So what are we doing with this currently? Well, one of the major problems that people undergoing radiation therapy and head and neck cancers is oral mucositis. And you can sort of think about this as a second degree sunburn on the inside of your mouth. And so it's a real issue in trying to treat patients undergoing radiation therapy in head and neck, because for a period of about 2 weeks, their quality of life is very, very rough. You know, they have dry mouth, trouble swallowing, eating. And so they really start to question, you know, is this really what I want to do? They're looking at, you know, 8 to 10 weeks of radiation 5 days a week, and 7 days into it, they feel this way. And so you get patients that, you know, abort therapy, they stop. There's all, you know, all kinds of issues. So, you know, can we do something to try to mitigate this? There are really no standard of care treatments in the clinic. Probably the most popular and effective is ice chips, just letting them just sort of suck on ice chips throughout the day to replace the moisture. The cooling helps, you know, deal with the pain. And then with the water, it helps with the dry mouth and things like that. Antiviral medications help. There's some, you know, calcium mouthwashes that they use and things like that. But the other thing that you get into dealing with during this time is, you know, antibacterial, antifungal infections. Mouth is very sore. You know, they're not swallowing, they're not eating, they're not brushing their teeth. So you're introducing, you know, other factors into the oral health of these patients. And, you know, anybody that's, you know, undergoing any sort of cancer treatment, you want them to try to be as healthy as possible. And having, you know, having to deal with oral mucositis in the mouth is not something that is going to be beneficial for them. And so this is just a schematic showing really what happens when you get the sloughing off of the epidermal cells, and you can get all the way down into some of the submucosa layers in the mouth, and that's really where the real pain comes in with these patients. So we have been working with a company to develop a knee mouth rinse. They have an over-the-counter Medicaid or mouth rinse standard, but we've got a much higher concentration of neem that we're using in the clinic. And the idea that we're looking at is this, you know, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and antimicrobial properties of the neem are going to help these patients in dealing with mucositis as well as just oral health throughout their whole treatment of radiation when they're undergoing that for their head and neck cancer. And so currently we have an R21 clinical trial at the Medical University of South Carolina, where I was before moving to Texas. And basically we're just looking at, you know, adults who have, you know, confirmed head and neck cancer, and they're scheduled for radiotherapy for greater than 7 weeks. And also with radiotherapy being their first time. If they're recurrent patients seeing radiation for the second time, their mucositis incidence rates drops to less than 5%. It seems that during that initial mucositis flare-up, it's the body becomes somewhat immune to it if you undergo secondary or even a tertiary round of radiotherapy. And so like I mentioned earlier, we reformulated this with the clinical trial. And it is a double-blinded placebo trial, so there are patients who are getting just mouth rinse without neem. And so far we've recruited about half of the patients. And from what's transpired so far, many of them like the mouth rinse. They seem to feel that it helps. It's kind of hard because we haven't fully looked at all the data, but the compliance is very high. And, you know, then as we As they come in each week, we take mouth rinse samples from them to look at the microbial environment, and then from the skin cells we'll look at different inflammatory signals from the cytokines and things like that, and some of the COX-2 expression that's taking place inside the oral cavity. So the success of this initial trial in terms of at least the anecdotal effect led us to look at, you know, can neem actually just prevent the primary oral cancer? In South Texas, oral cancer is on the rise, even with the decrease in tobacco use. It's still becoming an issue. And so we wanted to look at cell lines and mouse models to see if using the supercritical neem extract can actually, you know, treat or prevent oral cancer, and then look at, once again, you know, COX-2 suppression and some other markers of oral cancer and cancer proliferation in the oral cells. So the first thing that we did was just to look at treating two human oral cancer cell lines in vitro, and we can see that, you know, the neem does have a pretty toxic effect in both, you know, in both lines. The HSC3 seems to be a bit more sensitive than the SSC4, but either way, we're seeing at least in vitro that, you know, the neem can prevent the proliferation of oral cancer cells. And so we sort of took a leap of faith and moved to an in vivo model using nude mice, which have their thymus removed, so you can inject human cells into these animals. And what we did was we injected cells and let the cells settle for one day, and then a day later we started putting them on either a control diet or a diet that had 200 milligrams per kilogram neem. So they're getting their normal nutrients plus this dose of neem every day. And then after 10 days we started taking measurements on the tumors, and you can see that the neem was highly effective in reducing the growth rate of the tumors, almost a 60% reduction in tumor volume. The other interesting thing to note is the take rate. So for the control group, with just being on the standard diet, almost every tumor took inside the animal. But in the neem, we only had about 60% of the animals take a tumor. And we've worked with this line quite a bit. Our normal take rate is usually above 85 to 90%. So this was quite alarming in a good way to us that we were having such a high effect early on with treating these animals with the neem. And so we still have to look at, you know, what's going on in the cells in terms of the inflammatory blockade. But, you know, the neem seems to really have excellent safety, and, you know, the targets of inflammation and can be used orally, either as a mouth rinse, in the diet for animals. In terms of humans, I don't think we've got it to a point where you'll have humans chewing on just neem leaves or neem concoctions, but it could be something that in a somewhat of a tablet form, it could be beneficial. And currently, you know, there doesn't seem to be any offset side effects of the therapy. And so the other thing that we wanted to look at is moving forward with some other models of oral cancer. The 4NQO model actually mimics cheek and tongue cancer in the humans quite well from a morphological standpoint, and even into a biological and physiological standpoint, that it's actually in the mouth. And then, so we wanted to ask you, is it effective against other cancers? And so, like I said, the other cancer that we really look at is colorectal cancer in the lab. And there's a large amount of metadata and observational analysis that shows that COX inhibitors can reduce colorectal carcinogenesis, whether, you know, it's the Vioxx study or aspirin and things like that. So NSAIDs and things like that that prevent inflammation seem to have a benefit in reducing your risk of colorectal cancer. So we did the same thing that we did in the oral cancer lines with two colon cancer lines, and once again we can see a marked effect on these cells when treating with the neem. Surprisingly, these cells are actually much more sensitive than the oral cells when treated with the neem extract. We just did some staining of the cells using DAPI. We can show that we're increasing the apoptosis in these cell lines. And then without getting into too much biology, the main thing here is these two genes, BAX and BCL. Normally in a cancer cell, the BAX levels are very low, BCL2 levels are high. So if you reverse this ratio, you're producing a pro-apoptotic environment and leading to cell death, which the neem appears to be doing. And so, I've mentioned COX-2 in the progression of cancer, specifically in the colon cells. It can get remarkably high in some of these tumor cells. And although this picture doesn't show a very high level of COX-2 in these cells, the one thing to take home from this is that the neem seems to be reducing the amount of COX-2 protein levels in these cell lines. And so, once again, this anti-inflammatory blockade, is promising from the epidemiological studies and the cancer cell line work that we've done. But we need to look at expanding experiments on the colon cancer and other cell lines. And the one thing that we're currently undergoing right now is looking at the prevention of colon cancer using this neem extract in both of these animal models. So the xenograft model, like we did with the oral lines, we are doing that with the colon lines as well. And then we have a historic model of colon cancer, this AOM-APC min mouse that, much like the 4NQO model for oral cancer, this one really does mimic large bowel tumors in the human. So it gives us an ability to do some in vivo modeling before to understand how the neem is working in the animals before we try to look at anything in a clinical setting, at least from a cancer prevention standpoint. And so one of the last little things I wanted to talk about, I really spent a lot of time on neem, but the other things that we work on is some fruits from Colombia. So we're doing the same thing with Borojo and a few other tropical fruits there. We have a large study, at least in terms of in vitro right now, going on with the Pitanga fruit from Brazil, which will actually grow in the southern United States. Once again, the neem from India. And then probably the third biggest project in the lab is that of green tea. So we do a lot of work with green tea and EGCG, the major polyphenol. And lastly, the other major project is African mahogany. And we get our source from New South Wales and Australia, where they have large mahogany farms for the furniture trade, for them to build all the furniture in Southeast Asia. And they just have piles and piles of bark sitting around. Initially, we got some of this bark from the country of Guinea over here, but with the recent passing of one of our collaborators and then just the tensions and everything in that part of the world, the notion of being able to get an adequate supply has dwindled. And thankfully, this manufacturer in Australia has agreed to supply us with everything that we need. And the African mahogany itself is showing some very early promise. When we do the same sort of cell proliferation assays with supercritical extract, we're seeing a nice decrease in cell proliferation in these cancer cells. And once again, you know, we're seeing a decrease in COX-2 as we treat with the supercritical extract of mahogany. And so I know it was kind of a real cancer biology type talk, but I wanted it to focus on the idea of, you know, what takes place in terms of heavy wet labs with a lot of the plants and the breeding and things that go on when people start talking about fruits and vegetables and tropical production, and that if you can locate collaborators and people that are in the science community who do this type of work, we're always clamoring for people to, in the plant side of things, to work with, because sourcing, growing techniques, you know, the environment that they're in, if you can breed, grow them better to produce, you know, higher levels of these compounds, then it becomes even more beneficial in the long run. And with that, I just want to thank a lot of the people who've worked on this, and once again, the organizers for letting me speak. And if there's any questions, I'll do my best. Yes, sir.
Low dose aspirin, neem, green tea, oral, any evidence that these things work either additively or synergistically in a preventative mode?
So, synergistically with
anti-inflammatory, systemic.
So aspirin is the only one that has, you know, the long-term clinical data that shows, you know, decreased risk in, you know, cancer, heart disease, you know, just a plethora of different diseases. You know, 81 milligrams a day of aspirin.
Is 81 milligram dose enough to do that?
Or yes, and that's actually the interesting point. The 81 milligrams is actually better than taking, you know, 325 milligrams. It really does seem to have that, and that's the other thing that I didn't spend a little bit of time talking about here, is, you know, getting the dosing regime right. You know, is too much better, or is too little actually perfect? And so aspirin is, you know, it's the quintessential case study for everything, because they did compare it to people who had taking 325 or 500 milligrams a day, and the 81 milligrams came out stronger. And the other thing is, too, is if you've taken aspirin for a year and you stop, you still have that protective effect for up to a year after stopping. I mean, that's how chronic the benefit is. But with these others, the in vitro stuff in the cells and the animal models show similar patterns. But the problem with the chemoprevention area is, how do you write a 10-year clinical study? So you have to do a lot of meta-analysis and retrospective survey analysis from large studies like the NHANES study that they have going on in Boston, where these and looking at people's daily consumption of things, and then, you know, what diseases and what risk factors did they end up with throughout their life.
In the case of oral cancer,
In terms of the oral premalignant type tumors, no, as of this moment, because we are really the first group that's testing this and looking at oral cancer prevention. And so we just haven't gotten it into a point where we can start to look at clinical testing of this in oral patients, because in order to provide the benefit, you know, you have to say that this, you know, this is going to be better than the standard of care. And with surgery and chemo and radiation, we don't have enough data yet to write the protocols to get approval.
All right, let's give a big hand to the